Log Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for this program. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with a mover and shaker in the music world. Today's guest should need little introduction. He is legendary keyboard Roger Powell. Roger has just released a solo CD of piano improvisations titled Blue Note Ridge. I know that we have some fans listening in, so if you have a question for Roger, our switchboard is open today, and the number is area code 646-378-1120, or if you are too shy to actually talk to us, our chat room is also open, and you can put your questions in there, and time permitting, we'll try and get them on the air. Before I introduce Roger, though, let's listen to a track. This track is actually an adaptation of a Gershwin tune, Summertime. This is called Take to the Sky. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Simon. Glad to be here.
I was reading that repository of all knowledge and wisdom that is notorious for its inaccuracy, Wikipedia. So I have plenty of possibly inaccurate questions to ask you. Let's talk about the early days for a moment. Tell us about the good old days of Utopia.
Oh, my. Well, they actually were very, very good old days. It was a very exciting time for me. Actually, just to go back a couple of years before that, I put out a solo album of all synthesizer stuff called Cosmic Furnace. This is before I joined Utopia. And so it was very cool for me to get invited to actually play in a band. And that was an invitation from Todd Rundgren, of course. And I joined Utopia in 74. So back in those days, I was really interested in kind of jazz and experimental music and electronics. And I think people know that Todd was very much into early electronics as well. So I thought it would be a good platform to join this, to join the band and kind of work with Todd both on, you know, getting out and performing live in front of people, and also that we would, you know, kind of push the envelope on some of the technology of that day.
Hmm.
More? You want more?
I want more. Yeah,
okay.
I want more.
All right.
How many albums did you come out with Utopia?
Well, we did, I think we did around 10 actual Utopia albums, but in between recording those, which are, you know, they would say Utopia right on the, for the artist name, we also, the rest of the band participated on some of Todd's solo albums, and then Todd was also doing other productions. For instance, Meatloaf, some people may have heard of Meatloaf, Bad Out of Hell.
Yeah, I seem to vaguely recall that.
Yeah, put them in the Where Are They Now bin. Anyway, Meatloaf, oh, God, all kinds of people. Even Sean Cassidy. Sean Cassidy wanted to kind of, you know, get out of his little good boy image. And so, you know, he came to Todd because he figured Todd would sort of, you know, steer him in a different direction. Anyway, he did an album called Wasp. And Utopia essentially played on that album as well. But there was a host of other ones. Some more other stuff like Steve Hillage, who is a legendary, you know, kind of experimental English musician. We played on his couple of his albums as well. So we did all kinds of things besides the Utopia albums, but there were, I think, around 10 of those that were under the Utopia name.
As I recall, because I'm old.
Welcome to the club, dude.
Yeah, right. the very first song played on MTV was Video Killed the Radio Star.
Ah, yes.
In my mind, a more apt title might have been Punk Killed the Prog Rock Bands. You must have caught some of that punk backlash in the early 80s?
Yeah, we weren't, you know, living in a silo. I mean, we were making our own records at our own pace and, you know, expressing what we wanted to do. But we watched what was going on around us, and I think a lot of it, you know, before the punk movement came out, I think a lot of it was just sort of, there was extra just kind of crappy music coming out. I think there was an element of Utopia which kind of had a little bit of that punk edge, although, as I mentioned, you know, everybody in the band was a really good musician and could play various styles, and all of us had really short attention spans. So our albums tend to, like, span a lot of musical genres. And as far as, like, when the sort of punk and that kind of stuff started coming out, we were touring. What I remember is we actually got back from England, and we had noticed all this stuff kind of, you know, really taking hold there. And we decided, well, we can kind of answer that, you know, through our own Utopian filter. And we had a fairly hard-edged album called Oops, Wrong Planet that came out around that time. So I think we were, you know, we weren't the originators of that, but I think we could, you know, I think we knew how to sort of fit into some of that style. So, you know, people think of us, kind of categorize us, because, you know, these days you have to put a genre on something in order for it to be found in iTunes. and prog rock seems to be the genre. But if you actually take the whole body of work, you'll see that there's elements of all kinds of stuff that was going on. And that's probably to the detriment of the sales of the albums. I know the record company used to get really, really upset because they would go, you know, why can't you guys just do the same thing that you did the last time? And why can't you make all the songs sound the same on the album? And how come they're not all, you know, hits like Hello, It's Me? Well, that would throw Todd into a complete fit because they would assume that since he had written, you know, a few hits here or there, that like it was just automatic, you know, for him to write hits. And in point of fact, it's not automatic. And also, I would point out that one of the reasons for existence of Utopia was to kind of experiment with different styles and not try to compete with, the bands of the day that were sort of cranking out standard hits.
Right. What made you all decide to finally go your separate ways in, was that 85, somewhere around?
Yeah. Well, in 85, the band had been touring, you know, 11 or 12 years, and the record company was very, we went through a couple different record companies. The one we were mainly on was Bearsville, and that was Todd's solo album record company as well. Bearsville also had artists like Foghat and the guy who ran Bearsville was Albert Grossman, and he was Bob Dylan's manager and Janis Joplin's manager. So anyway, Bearsville was affiliated with, they were a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. But I think, once again, pointing back to what I just talked about, they didn't really want Todd to do Utopia albums. And the Utopia Records, this is an interesting little historical fact, Utopia Records actually came from the deal that Todd had for his solo albums. But Todd decided that every other solo album that he was contracted for, he would do with the band as a band album. And every time we would go to do it, they would go, oh, crap, you know, another one of these Utopia albums that is, quote, experimental, all over the map. And why don't you just go back and write more of those darn hits that we all know and love? So the point I'm getting to is that we never really had the full support of the record company. Even though we were out there, like, you know, touring our brains out, which did help us sell albums, and I think, you know, a lot of the popularity of the band came from the very exciting live performances. I think we did a really good job at performing live, you know, especially after you've done a few hundred shows, you sort of know what you're doing.
Right.
So we never really had the full record company support. We changed labels a couple times at the end, and things just kind of didn't gel with that. The music business itself was kind of changing, and I think we were just all kind of tired of batting our heads against the wall. You know, every time we come out with an album, we wouldn't get the promotion that was promised, and it was kind of time for people to kind of take a break and look at other avenues of expression, if you will.
Right. I interviewed Ken Hensley of Uriah Heep not very long ago.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know, he tells a horrible story about, you know, how you can be the superstar. They give you the world. You know, if you need 10 limos at the airport, you get 10 limos. But there is no free lunch. And, you know, you go on a world tour, which is a sellout deal, but at the end of the day, you still end up in the red with the record company.
Yeah, the record companies were sort of like a mortgage holder. And they would kind of string you along. They would, you know, they give you some money in advance. And I know you want to talk later about like how the music business has changed, and I want to get around to that. But it was very different back then, and it was totally controlled by the record companies. You had to get an advance from the record company, A, so you could live on and pay your rent while you were recording, and B, so that they could, they would pay for the studio time, would get recouped out of your royalties, et cetera. They would advance you this money, which you then sort of used to, move your career along. But if you didn't recoup all of it, you essentially went into the hole on the next record. So the next record, they'd give you an advance, but they would subtract what you already owed them. So they would ensure, basically, that you owe them money and that you just got barely enough to, cover the production costs. And then that, of course, forced you to do more touring. Not that you shouldn't be touring, but it just meant that, a lot of us, the touring thing was kind of a new thing for me. And I enjoyed, when I went into all of it, I was more of a really thinking, oh, great, this is going to be really cool, man. I get to spend all this time in the studio. I love being in the studio. You can play with all the equipment and use your synthesizers and take your time. So, when the touring thing got to be sort of, not really constant, but like a lot of the months of the year, it started to take something out of you. And then, you realized you were doing it to support the record company.
Right. Yeah, I've heard this story time and time again from musicians from the 70s and 80s. In fact, a couple of years ago, I went to a concert, and I can't remember the name of the band, but I got to talk with the drummer afterwards, and basically they play something like 300 gigs a year, and it's no new music because no one wants to hear anything new. So for 35 years, these poor guys, just climb on airplanes, go somewhere, play the same tune.
That's like being on a chain gang, That's like a life sentence.
Yeah.
I think, we had some of the same, we never toured, we never had 300 shows a year. That only leaves 65, that's what, 65 days is like 2 months of your own time. No, maybe, now it could be they were doing four shows a day. We did a bar tour, I think it was called Back to the Bars, and some of those places we were doing 3 to 4 shows a night. Now, they were only an hour, but nevertheless, it was really, really hard work. And again, people wouldn't, they really wouldn't want to hear. I mean, this is even back before, this is not like we have gone out and done all of these reunion tours or anything where you're completely stuck playing all your old material. But audiences, they really wanted to hear what you did before, and they were somewhat reluctant to, to get excited about new material. I would say that Utopia audience is better than most because they expected new material, to come out. But yeah, you get into a drone kind of a situation there, and that's sort of why I kind of never got back into any serious touring after the band broke up. I just couldn't see reproducing the same stuff every night over and over and over again for the next 30 years.
Right.
Plus, I got kind of sidetracked into technology.
That's a great segue into my next question. To some, you were, and indeed maybe still are, a bit of an anathema. Clearly you're a wonderful and talented musician, but you're also an electronics whiz and a computer guy. What's your favorite hat? What do you like doing best?
Well, it kind of goes back, just to give people a little perspective, when I was in high school, I was studying music. I studied piano, actually ended up with a pretty capable university professor, when I was studying piano. And I played trumpet in a high school band. And then I got a job. I was a disc jockey. Well, you know, now DJ means something completely different these days, but back then you actually, you know, you jockeyed discs. you played records and talked about it and so forth. And so I worked at the radio station, and they had tape recorders. And so I started kind of putting two and two together and said, well, you know, I can record my own music. And then I kind of started messing around with cutting tape up and got interested in sort of kind of experimental, what they called it back then, they called it musique concrète, which was actually people taking, they would record sounds, chop up the tape, and re-splice it together backwards and all that sort of thing. So this, a light bulb kind of went off in my head that, like, hey, wait a minute, this using this equipment to kind of manipulate music is pretty cool as well. I ended up in a recording studio in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1968, and I kind of learned my trade there. And I convinced that guy, the owner of that studio, to get one of the first synthesizers that came out. It was actually the was called an EMS VCS3, affectionately known as the Putney, because the factory was in Putney, England. And at that point, the synthesizers were starting to be heard and used in mostly commercials. You know, you hear these funny little electronic sounds.
Right.
And so I convinced the studio owner, who did a lot of jingles, he did radio jingles, to get one. And, you know, then I just went kind of nuts. I was like, wow, here's an instrument that you can kind of make a whole bunch of different sounds on. Not, you know, if you play a trumpet, you can pretty much, if you're good, you can make it sound like a trumpet. Otherwise, it's not very versatile, you know, in terms of like getting different sounds. So I was really addicted to the idea that I could make different sounds with the synthesizer and put them on different tracks of a multi-track tape recorder. So I just kind of went off the deep end with with that stuff, and that resulted, you know, in the 1973 album Cosmic Furnace, which was all sort of electronic jazz rock, if you will. And, you know, the next logical step a few years later when personal computers came out was to begin to look into writing software that would control the synthesizers and make them play things that, you know, you either couldn't play yourself or, B, you were too lazy to.
Right. Rumor has it you had some hand in developing a polyphonic synthesizer.
I actually worked on two different projects there. The first one was a controller, which means that it's an instrument which looked like a keyboard, except I made it portable so you could kind of sling it around your neck. That was called the Powell Probe.
Yes, I've heard about that.
Those things are now kind of referred to generally as keytars. keytar. And I worked with a guy that had worked with me at the ARP Synthesizer Company. I spent some time there, and I designed the thing, and he sort of did the electronics and, you know, helped get the shell of the shape and all that together. And so we built that, and that actually controlled six separate synthesizers, but the synthesizers, the things that actually made the sound, those were off stage. Because, you know, in those days, you didn't have all the tiny chips now that they have in the synth that, you know, you can make things really small. But that keyboard, you know, it looked like I was holding a keyboard that was jammed into a guitar, and it looked like a guitar cable coming off of it. But there was a lot more information going down that cable to those instruments that were off stage. So that was called the Powell Probe. That was kind of fun because I got to move around and, you know, kind of compete with the you know, with the chip quotient of the lead guitar player, you know. And then I did another instrument later on, which was a fully digital synthesizer, and that was called the Data Boy. And that was actually, I hand-built a computer and found this card you could plug in that would make synthesizer sounds. And I kind of turned that into a touring instrument. So there were two things there in terms of instrument design.
You had some dealings with the late Robert Moog, as I recall.
Yeah, I'm very lucky and fortunate to legitimately claim that he was a friend of mine, and I spent numerous days and hours and whatever actually consulting with him. At the time, these were like, this is like, you know, mid to late 70s, on some newer stuff that he was working on. And I was an endorser of Moog products back then. I had two really big Moog synthesizers that I took on tour for a while. And he personally, like, you know, soldered some of those parts together. Actually, it's a really quick, interesting story about those. This was a custom big, you know, couple of big cabinets of Moog modules, you know, with all the patch cords.
Oh, yeah.
It had a custom keyboard that I designed with him, or he designed with me. And we played two nights in a concert hall. I came in the second night, and the keyboard was stolen.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they stole the keyboard, so I had no way to control the synthesizers. We found some other substitute at the time, but, you know, it wasn't the thing that I had designed. The keyboard showed up 26 years later on eBay.
did you buy it back?
I bought it back, yeah. And the guy who sold it to me was younger than the keyboard. And he had gotten it. He said he found it at some party. Some guy had a whole pile of crap, like, sitting in a storage unit. And it was much worse for the wear. It looked like it had been sitting out in the rain for a while. But the additional twist on the story is that after that keyboard got stolen, after a couple of years, I started using a different synthesizer, and the big Moogs burned up in a warehouse fire. So first I lost the keyboard to being stolen. Then the actual synth burned up in the fire. And then so the only artifact that I have of that era is now the keyboard, because somebody stole it and I bought it back on eBay.
Okay, it was about 18 months ago. I managed to get an interview with Keith Emerson. And he tells the best Moog story I think I've ever heard.
Oh, great.
He persuaded his buddies in ELP, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, that what he needed was a modular Moog. So he bought one. And Keith's version of the story is that one day a moving truck turned up outside his door with 9 crates of stuff. And poor Keith was, you know, living in a very small apartment in London.
Wow.
He spent a week trying to figure out, you know, how to plug it all together.
Where to put it.
Right. Well, the Moog consumed almost all of the apartment.
Yes.
And finally had to call an expert to try and put it together, and that expert happened to be Robert Moog. And Robert said to him, this is not a touring instrument.
Right.
Stick this in a studio. So what does Keith do? Oh, he takes... In fact, he still has the Moog, and it is up and running in a studio in... Los Angeles, which is where Keith lives.
Yeah, I of course Keith is extremely well known for, you know, promoting the Moog synthesizer and being, you know, brave as myself in taking these instruments, which were designed to be, you know, they actually weren't that stable. The pitch would drift, and you know, this and that would happen to them. They really were not that amenable to touring. Plus, it took a whole bunch of modules just to make one sound, and you had to set the damn thing up every night with all the patch cords. So I always admired Keith for for his for his courageousness there.
Oh yeah, you were also one of the very early adaptees of the MIDI movement. In fact, rumor has it you actually developed your own sequencer.
Yeah, I got, you know, I progressed from my early computer experiments where, you know, I was having them actually control big modular synthesizers. And then we noticed, you know, I was getting kind of good, actually, at computer programming, and I had this whole idea about, you know, creating a program that musicians could use to compose with. And about the same time, the MIDI spec came out. Now, MIDI was one of the coolest things that ever happened because it allowed, you know, synthesizers to be controlled from keyboards. Now, actually, this probe thing I had was before MIDI, but it essentially did what MIDI, you know, when MIDI was invented, what it was intended to do, which was to take, you know, a controller that doesn't make any noise, but connect it to things that do make noise, and then you can cook them all together in kind of a network. So I thought, well, this is really cool, but what's missing is a program that you run on your computer that would allow you to record, you know, your gestures, your keystrokes, and then put that into, you know, string these patterns together into a song. So I wrote this program. It was called Texture, and it came out, I believe, in around 1984. And it was very popular in large part because there was no other software people could get. It ran on the IBM PC, and I had several celebrity users of that software, including Stevie Wonder, who credited me on a couple of albums as, here you go, consultant.
I'll tell you what, Roger, we have a caller on the line, and I'd love to bring the caller on. Caller from the 214 area code. What's your name and what's your question for Roger?
Hi, Simon. Hi, Roger. This is Mel. I'm half of the Rundgren Radio promo team with Doug.
Oh, Martin. My.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Very good. I wanted to compliment you on the beautiful piano playing in that opening song. How's the new CD going along?
Well, actually, I have some exciting news about that. We essentially, and this was co-produced by Gary Tannen, who I also worked with on the previous more electronic album, Fossil Poets, from 2006. But we decided, okay, let's just do the piano album. We'll put it out. We'll distribute it ourselves. We would mostly, we said, let's just go for digital downloads this time. So we did that for a few months. It came out in March. And it started to kind of pick up some steam, and people really wanted to buy CDs. So I'm very, very happy to announce, and I think there'll be a formal thing about this coming out. But we got picked up by a prog rock label, say that three times, in Canada, called Unicorn Digital. And we're going to be distributed worldwide with CDs out of Unicorn Digital. They also did a very amazing thing and said, hey, would you like some surrealistic album cover art to go with this? And I said, well, yeah, you know, give me a try on it. And so we've redone the album art, and it is just purely gorgeous. You'll have to wait to see it, but the guy who's actually the head of the record label is apparently a fabulous graphic artist, and he's done a really, really nice new layout that includes some kind of surrealistic looking mountains and a stream and a really like beat up looking keyboard with water flowing on it. It's really cool. So anyway, look for Blue Note Ridge on Unicorn Digital pretty soon. Come to find out, people are still buying CDs in Canada and Europe.
Surprise.
So thanks for mentioning that. I'm hoping it's going to do better than it has. The thing is, if you don't tour behind an album, if you're not out there, you know, playing, you don't really get much sales anymore. But I didn't do this to make money. In fact, I'm losing money hand over fist with both this and Fossil Poets. But luckily, I have a day job, and I'm able to kind of like, you know, do this as a professional hobby.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, in fact, about a little side job that you've got planned for later this summer, performing the Todd Rundgren's A Wizard A Wizard, A True Star album live in Akron, Ohio. I wanted to ask you what you think about being back on stage with, well, most of Utopia.
I thought it was a great opportunity. I haven't played in that type of a situation or with Todd since 1992, so you can do the math there. So I'm kind of scared to death, but at the same time, it seemed like a really good situation to get back. And it's not an extended tour, so my boss at work says, yeah, go ahead and do that. It's cool, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be fun to see everybody again, to see, you know, not only the guys in the band, but also the loyal and true and dedicated fans who've, you know, stuck with Todd and our music over the years.
Okay, I'll tell you what, on that note, I think we should take a little musical break. This is Ghost Ripples.
Yeah, hold on a second. I just want to say something about this piece of music.
Sure.
The piano album is pretty much just all, you know, microphones in front of the piano. On this piece, I tried, it's very short, too. It's only about a minute long. It's kind of like a little meditation, if you will. But on this piece, you have to listen real carefully. I don't know how well it's going to come across through the Internet. But I added some effects that I put on the piano. They're mostly kind of like echo effects, but I had this thing in mind, and I may do more of this in the future, but listen closely, because you'll hear some extra stuff in there.
Okay, all right, so this is Ghost Ripples.
There you go. It works well with an adult beverage.
I've got to admit that a couple of the tracks on the CD, I kind of sense an anger in the music. Is that just me seeing things that aren't there?
Wow, I haven't heard that. What I have heard is people say, oh my God, it's so sad. Is everything okay? this is an album that I wanted to make for years and years, and people always told me that, you know, what I like to do to relax is just to sit down at my piano, you know, in the evening when it's quiet and it's dark, and just kind of improvise. And I've been doing this for years. I mean, I've been doing it since I was 15 years old. And I never had the chance to just kind of, let that all kind of hang out and do that. I do need to tell people that these pieces were not preconceived in any way. When I sat down and turned the tape deck on, although it's digital, I had no idea what I was going to play, and they're all just stream of consciousness pieces of music. They were done over a period of a couple of months with different sessions. But so what you're hearing there is just whatever was kind of coming out of my soul, you know, through my brain and fingers. The anger thing is kind of interesting. I'll have to because the whole album is in a way is kind of meditative. I think it's kind of meditative.
There was a couple of tracks, and I can't recall them right off the top of my head. Maybe track one. It it just came across to me as
yes.
as being an angry piece.
I like that. I was tending to think like, oh, it's just kind of wimpy dinner music, but now I'm finding out it's actually angry music. Everybody's got a little bit of whatever in there. I think probably what you're hearing is I really love really dense note clusters that mm-hmm. have, there's a lot of dissonance in it. Now, maybe your perception is equating like, the dissonance. I like to just play a whole bunch of notes jammed together. They are actually very carefully thought out. I'm not just like hitting my elbow on the piano. But I do like dense note clusters, and I tended to think of a lot of the album as I grew up listening to a lot of contemporary contemporary American classical music, and this was stuff like Aaron Copland and William Schumann and people that probably a lot of the audience may or may not have heard of. But that was the kind of music that I kind of liked. It was a little bit intellectual, and it was a little stretch of your brain because the harmonies weren't just really simple three-note chords. So maybe that's what you're hearing.
Right. That certainly could be. One of the interesting things that I've done in my life, and I've done more than one interesting thing.
Good for you.
Right, is to try and interview as many 70s and 80s prog rock folks as I can find.
God bless you, sir.
I love it. Prog's my passion, if you will. And I also interview a lot of other musicians, but there's a disproportionate percentage of prog rock musicians that have classical training. You mentioned earlier that you had a music professor, which
right.
to me means this is another one. I can chalk up another tick mark on the wall. Yep, here's another prog rock guy with a classical training. Why is it?
For me, I grew up listening to classical music. My dad, most all the men in my family were in the construction business. A lot of them were brick masons, including my dad. But he was not just a redneck. He was kind of an intellectual, and he listened to classical music, and he loved opera. So I grew up listening to all that, and that was what was in the house. I had a real appreciation for that. And I think, of course, as many parents, your parents want you to do something creative that they always wanted to do themselves but were never able to accomplish. So they started me on piano lessons, and I followed through with all of that. I was mostly interested in classical music throughout high school. And I think what happens, I think if you listen to prog rock in general, you'll see that there's lots of times there's lots of notes. Lots of times there's lots of classical style runs, and chords and harmony. It's not your average sort of, ZZ Top blues type of thing. There's lots of rhythm changes. And I think a lot of that comes from the classical influence. Obviously, we're using instruments that they didn't have back then. They didn't have amplifiers in Beethoven's day. Actually, he could have used it. He went deaf, but he didn't go deaf from stage monitors, as most of us have now. I got a big dip in my hearing at 4 kilohertz, is that sort of what you were looking for there? It's like, how come the guys who play prog rock mostly seem to have classical backgrounds?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's more than coincidence.
Yeah, I think, but I, like I say, I think like the resulting music from people who have studied classical is that the music itself is going to have some more interesting structure, you know, some more interesting forms, and not afraid to, you know, do things that are a little more inventive, a little more musically, you know, creative.
Right. I mean, a prog rocker that I have followed for many, many years is Rick Wakeman.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Yes anyway in my brain there.
And you know, when I spoke to Rick about it, he said something very similar to what you said, and his background is mostly similar. And what I find interesting is that most of Rick's latest endeavors have involved the piano, you know, rather than the synthesizer.
Right.
And, you know, he likes the piano. He loves the sound that synthesizers and organs give, but when it comes right down to creating, nothing quite beats the good old piano.
Well, you know, you've got Blue Note Ridge sitting right there as a testament to that. I think that, you know, if you have learned to play the piano, then you have probably developed this, you know, very sincere relationship with that instrument that it's almost like it's a member of your family, and it becomes like a very primary means of expression for you. I mean, it's a very versatile instrument. You've got a left hand and a right hand. You've got all those notes that you can play. You've got a lot of subtlety of the sounds. There have been a lot of orchestral composers who originally wrote their scores just on the piano and then created arrangements for the orchestra. So it's a very expressive, wide-ranging instrument, and I would also go back to, and I'm sure Rick feels this way too, that, you know, you've developed a personal bond with that instrument, and it just becomes, if you're good, it becomes an extension of your, you know, of your soul and your brain.
Actually, interestingly enough, I've also talked to a number of well-known guitar players who are writers, and I would say that probably something like 60, maybe 70% of them do their tinkering on the piano rather than the guitar.
I could see that. You know, again, you've got a left hand and a right hand. So the left hand can play the bass, and the right hand can play, you know, the lead. And it's much harder to do on a guitar. You know, there are instruments which are designed that you can kind of play like that, like stringed instruments. There's a thing called the stick, which came out a long time ago. But the stick is basically kind of like a guitar, but you actually use two hands on it, and there's a set of bass strings and a set of treble strings. So I think on the piano, you're kind of able to emulate, you know, more parts at once, if you will, which is, of course, critical for, you know, composing. I mean, you know, if you're really good, you can actually play three or four parts at once with your two hands on the piano. If you look at a lot of Bach's music for the keyboard, you know, he has things which are called, you know, four-part fugues. That means you're actually playing four melody lines at the same time that are all interleaving. And that's tricky, but you can do it. And I think it's simply much harder on a guitar, because generally on a guitar, your left hand is selecting the notes and your right hand is just triggering them. So you don't get that dual-handed thing where both hands are, you know, can operate independently.
Right. We're almost out of time, and I'm almost halfway through my questions.
Yeah.
Right. Oops.
We'll have to do a follow-up.
We will, but let's see if we can squeeze in a couple more questions.
Okay.
As I understand it, you worked for Apple Computer for about 10 years. What were you doing with Apple?
Well, I actually worked for them for 11 and a half years. I started with them in 97. I'd been at a technology job for Silicon Graphics before that. When I went to work for Apple, I started working as a senior software engineer. I was writing code for this program, this video editing software, which is called Final Cut Pro. It came out, I guess, in 98 or 99. It's a it became very, very popular piece of software that runs on the Mac that's used to edit, well, now it's used to edit not only video, but film as well. Very, very popular. It came out at just the right time when personal computers were becoming powerful enough to do video editing. And I was lucky enough to land this job at Apple working on that. I was working a lot on the support in the program. It's like a timeline editor for audio and video.
Hmm.
So I actually worked on a bunch of the audio support in there. Like when you go to, there's a window that you can bring up, and it'll show you the waveforms of the audio that you're using in your production. I actually wrote the drawing code for that, and that's probably the most visible thing. Over the years, I got sort of more into technical lead, which means that you're not writing as much code, but you're kind of coordinating other engineers who are working on the project. A little more of a kind of a management type of a position. So, they kind of kick you upstairs a little bit.
right.
And then you get all these like bright, young kids out of college. And let them do the all-nighters, write the code,
Yeah.
So I did that, and that was great. I did it for 11 and a half years, and then a new opportunity came along.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
You're now with Electronic Arts. That's mainly a game manufacturer.
Yeah, they're probably one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known game companies. They were founded in 1982. They got a lot of good games and a lot of hits out there. And I got the opportunity. It just kind of like just sort of happened. It wasn't like I was really, actively searching for something else to do. I was fairly happy there at Apple. But it turns out that there are some people here that are in a kind of a high-level creative office, and these are kind of the folks that, a lot of new ideas, they come up with a lot of new ideas, and new ideas get pitched to them, and they wanted somebody to help them out with some music research. There's a very popular set of games out there now called Rock Band and Guitar Hero,
right.
And there's a lot of people that play those things. And so they wanted to get somebody on board who, had a lot of both music experience, technological experience, and also some, amount of project management experience. So I'm running on all cylinders here. everything that I've ever done in my life is like, my experiences are being brought to bear in this new job. And I'm working on super secret stuff. So.
Oh, perfect. I'll ask you, what super secret stuff, and I promise not to tell any of the people listening in.
suffice to say, well, the whole project that I'm working on is not, hasn't been fully defined yet. I've only been here a month.
I was joking.
Yeah, I know, and like I know people, want information, and to tell you the truth, I wish I knew. but we're working on, some projects and some technologies that might appeal to the people who, have already worked with those other music games. What we're working on is something in the music game area, but that's about all I can say.
Where can people find you online, and where can people buy copies of Blue Note Ridge?
Well, there's the ever-popular iTunes, I think you can get CDs from, well, today you can still get them from CD Baby. You can find, we're going to be out on Unicorn. I think maybe next month. It's taken them, you know, a little while to ramp up and actually make the CDs and so forth. But I believe you'll probably be able to find it through, you can still find it today, like through Amazon, and we're listed on everybody. We're on Amazon, we're on Napster, we're on, there's a really cool download site called Mind Dawn, M-I-N-D-A-W-N. And the cool thing about them is that they offer really high resolution versions of the music. You know, when you order stuff from these other places, they usually come down in MP3 format, and they've been compressed in a certain way to make them smaller so you can get more of them on your player. But sometimes the audio actually suffers from that. So we're, you know, you can kind of decide. I think you have to pay a little bit more, but you do get almost CD, well, you get CD quality actually out of that, but it is a download. So I think if you just Google it. The other thing is we have a MySpace. This is not actually run by me, but there's a MySpace Fossil Poets, F-O-S-S-I-L-P-O-E-T-S, and that has a lot of information about where to find both this album and the previous groovy, more electronic one from 06 called Fossil Poets.
All right. I want to thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon. We've run over time by, oh, who knows how long.
You told me to keep you're the one who told me to keep jabbering, dude.
Yeah, right. So it's all my fault.
Okay.
I want to establish that. I want to thank you immensely for agreeing to talk to me. It has been just a fabulous time, and I want to wish you every success with your new endeavors at Electronic Arts, and of course, I want to wish you every success with Blue Note Ridge. And I think on that note, I'm not sure how long my producer is actually going to keep my show on the air, but I would like to end today with another track from Blue Note Ridge. And this track is Blue and Gray.
Blue and Gray. Thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and I do hope we can talk again soon.
Anytime you like.
Okay.